The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Well, it is nice to see such a great turnout for the German Revolution. Yesterday I attended a very good presentation on the Portuguese Revolution, and there was one person who was actually an eyewitness to a guy who the Portuguese Revolution. I assume there's no one here who is an eyewitness to the German Revolution. So, ideally I would have some PowerPoint images, but this would be somewhat anachronistic, and I want to keep things as authentic as possible, so I will talk about the German Revolution in German. Well, I will not do that, but I will do it with a German accent, of course. Okay, I have a handout, and I think almost everyone, if not everyone, has a copy of this handout. And hopefully the handout will be somewhat helpful in terms of getting a sense of the timeline of the spelling of various names and some organizations, because the German Revolution can be a little confusing, since some of those names are not necessarily household names, even though they should be, given the significance of the German Revolution. And there are some pictures here, and these pictures are numbered. Unfortunately, they cannot be any bigger, but hopefully they will be somewhat helpful and recognizable. And at the very beginning, there's a list of names, and the numbers here correspond to the numbers of the pictures. So hopefully, as I go through my presentation, all of that will make sense. And at the very end of the handout, in terms of the text, there's a list of recommended readings. And there will not be a test at the end, of course, but for those who want to read further about the German Revolution, and this is a very good book, Pierre Bourret's classic on the German Revolution, but this is also a fairly formidable book. So for those who want to read further about the German Revolution but might be a little intimidated by the size of this volume, I would recommend several other volumes as well, and you see them here under recommended readings. First of all, a book that just has come out, William Pelz's A People's History of the German Revolution, 1918-1919. And I want to very briefly welcome Adrian, who is the widow of Bill Pelz, wonderful friend and comrade who passed away just recently. He has written many books about the revolutionary movements in Europe as well as in America. He was a wonderful comrade, and I encourage everyone to look at his books, not only, but also this book on the German Revolution, the People's History of the German Revolution. I also recommend Chris Harman's The Lost Revolution, Germany 1918 to 1923. It distills many of the ideas in this volume, and it's not as formidable in terms of size. And then for those who like gigantic volumes, John Riddell's To the Masses, Proceedings of the Third Congress of the Communist International, which is a very good documented piece on the Third Comintern Congress and its observations on the German Revolution. There's one more book, not quite as page heavy, but very good analysis. Ralph Hofrock's Working Class Politics in the German Revolution. Richard Müller, the revolutionary shop stewards and the origins of the council movement. And that book is important also because it diversifies our perspective a little bit by paying attention to an often neglected phenomenon, the so-called revolutionary shop stewards, and I will talk about them a little bit in my presentation as well. Okay, so let me very briefly say something about why we should be mindful of the German Revolution. Obviously, to some of us, it's the most important event in human history. It is a very important event in the history of the modern world. It's very important to the international socialist tradition. It's very important to socialists in general, not only by what the German Revolution accomplished, but by what it could have accomplished if it had turned out differently. Arguably, two of the greatest catastrophes in the 20th century would not have happened if the German Revolution had been successful. And I'm talking here about the rise of fascism, of Nazism in Germany, and the rise of Stalinism in the Soviet Union. History, of course, is always open-ended, so while we should focus on what actually happened, we should also be mindful of the unfulfilled possibilities, the roads not taken. The German Revolution was part of a wave of revolutions that developed out of the turmoil of World War I, starting with the unrest in Ireland, all the way to the Russian revolutions in 1917, the Hungarian Revolution, the unrest in Great Britain, in Spain. There's a whole revolutionary wave, revolutionary era that unfolds between World War I and then closes in 1923 when the German Revolution ends. So the German Revolution was perhaps the high point of this revolutionary era. The Russian Bolsheviks pinned their hopes on the German Revolution. Many of you are familiar with Lenin's famous statement, "Without Germany, we are lost." Their desperate hope that a revolution, a victorious revolution in Germany, will provide aid for the Bolsheviks in Russia, who in the summer of 1918, when the revolution in Germany was just about to break out, were in dire straits. Lenin at that point thought the situation in Russia was near hopeless, and he concluded it's probably time very soon, when we lose, to go underground again. Viktor Serge, another Bolshevik, was a little more pessimistic. He said, "We cannot hold much longer. Within a few months, all of us will either be shot or hanged." So that gives you a sense of the desperation of the situation in Russia and this yearning for a revolution elsewhere, especially the German Revolution that was to provide aid to the people in Russia. What can one learn from the German Revolution? Well, it brings into focus key tactical and strategic issues for the revolutionary left. It compels us to think about issues such as reform versus reformism, revolution and reformism and how they relate, parliamentary versus council democracy, the nature of the state, whether the state is something neutral that different formations and different classes can use for their interests, or whether the state is an instrument of class rule and different classes require different kinds of states. The German Revolution forces us to confront something that is sometimes referred to as ultra-leftism, sectarianism, tendency that sometimes goes hand in hand with passivity, radical slogans on the one hand, but abstentionism from actual struggles on the other hand, the idea of socialism from below, a whole range of issues that are of great importance to the left. German Revolution was a time when hundreds of thousands of people were radicalized, was the high point of a revolutionary wave. So it's a time period that is of great importance to our time in terms of looking for lessons and preparing for another wave that will hopefully materialize. And we have to be ready because whatever happened during the German Revolution, there were lots of opportunities that turned out to be lost opportunities. But again, it's very dangerous to draw simplistic lessons because historical constellations are unique. They never repeat themselves in the same fashion. So looking at the German Revolution means we should learn how to think creatively and how to confront issues in a unique fashion, theorizing them deeply, deepening our historical knowledge as opposed to just engaging in sloganizing. My focus, the focus of my particular presentation, will be on the Social Democratic Party and how the Social Democratic Party has in some ways betrayed the revolution. That might be of significance today, in as much as there is a resurgent interest in social democracy with the rise of the Bernie Sanders phenomenon and the interest in socialism, but no clear understanding what socialism might actually mean and what a difference is between revolutionary socialism and social democracy and so on and so forth. And secondly, I want to look at what kinds of organizations working class would need in order to be effective as an alternative to social democratic organizations, and whether the organizations that developed during the German Revolution, most prominently the German Communist Party, the KPD, were effective, whether they were effective enough. All right, so maybe at this point we should take a quick look at our handout. Page number one, the first page with the pictures. And if you go to picture number five, you see three individuals there. Not the three musketeers, but in the middle, Emperor William II, surrounded by Paul von Hindenburg on the left and Erich Ludendorff on the right. This picture was taken during the war, but I want to say something briefly about the situation prior to the war. The emperor was the head of Imperial Germany. So in order to understand the German Revolution, we have to get a sense of what kind of state Imperial Germany was. And if you look at the handout, moving from the picture to the actual text, Imperial Germany, it's sort of difficult to classify because it was in some ways an autocracy, but it had democratic features. It was a capitalist society that had at the same time a great deal of power for pre-capitalist aristocratic elite, and it was one of the most rapidly industrializing and modernizing societies. Within a few decades, it surpassed Great Britain as Europe's most industrialized society. It was, in some ways, an archaic society in terms of its political structure, in as much as a feudal elite had still a great deal of power, and on the other hand, it was the world's most modern, at least Europe's most modern, capitalist society. An immensely diverse, immensely dynamic society, and it had the world's largest socialist party, the Social Democratic Party. This party developed from a relatively obscure and persecuted organization into a gigantic machine that by 1912 got more votes than any other single political party in Germany. And the Social Democratic Party was of course composed of many different wings. There were revolutionaries, there were revisionists, the revolutionaries, well, the most famous revolutionary Marxist was Rosa Luxemburg. The most famous or infamous revisionist was Eduard Bernstein. Then there were the so-called centrists, a fellow often referred to as the Pope of Marxism, Karl Kautsky. So different currents of intellectuals and theoreticians. And there was a party apparatus, a growing party apparatus, party bureaucrats. And if you take a look at picture number one and picture number two, you see one such party bureaucrat, Friedrich Ebert, who came to dominate the party machine in the late, after the death of August Bebel. Picture number one is a drawing, a caricature by George Gross, and it's not entirely flattering. That's why I put an actual photograph next to it to show the real Friedrich Ebert. The point of this caricature is to point out certain things. The most important thing here is Ebert was a bureaucrat. He was a bureaucrat interested in bureaucratic things. His most important contribution was not to theoretical debates, but to the fact that every party office should have a typewriter. He was practical-minded, but he had a fairly limited horizon. His objective was to improve the fate of the party in terms of getting more votes and of not endangering anything in terms of risk-taking. And he wanted to get respectability for the party. He wanted to include the party into the fabric of power in Imperial Germany. And the party was still largely excluded, even though it was the largest single party in terms of their vote share in the Reichstag, in parliament. It did not have any meaningful influence over policies until the summer of 1914, when war was about to break out. And the question was, how will the Social Democratic Party respond to it? And according to the principles of the Social Democratic Party, a Marxist party, the party was to oppose the war. But the party leadership decided to not oppose the war, but actually support the war effort, for a variety of different reasons. One reason was pure opportunism. They thought it was too dangerous to oppose the war, but they also wanted to be seen as respectable, as finally being included in the power-sharing arrangements, and perhaps that would translate into getting a little more power down the road. Also, all of that based on Germany winning the war. Only a minority of party leaders had grave concerns about supporting the war to the point of openly resisting it. And one such person was Karl Liebknecht, and you see his image on picture number three, together with Rosa Luxemburg. Liebknecht and Luxemburg were members of the Spartacus group. The Spartacus group was a group of revolutionary socialists within the Social Democratic Party. Luxemburg was by far the most brilliant intellectual. Franz Mehring once called her the most brilliant Marxist mind since Marx. And Luxemburg fought against the tendencies within the party to either water down Marxist revolutionary doctrine in terms of the revisionism of Eduard Bernstein, and she fought against bureaucratic compromises as well, but she fought against those things largely as an individual, because her fear was that fighting against these tendencies by creating a new party would isolate her, would isolate revolutionary socialists. So while this Spartacus group existed within the party, this Spartacus group was actually a very loose association. It was not a coherent and cohesive organization. And Luxembourg was quite concerned about doing anything to endanger party unity. Okay, to make a long story short, Liebknecht eventually breaks with the party line. He, contrary to Luxembourg, is a deputy in the Reichstag, in parliament, and he votes against supporting war credits. And but he is one member of the SPD parliamentary delegation. And in 1914, he has few allies. But that changes. In 1917, the sentiment turns against the war, not only among the working class, which was never really that enthusiastic about the war, but even among segments of the middle class. And the Social Democratic Party actually splits, and a left-wing independent Social Democratic Party, USPD, is created. Fast forwarding a little bit, the war goes badly, and eventually the military leadership will recognize that. The military leadership is essentially in charge. Neither the German Chancellor nor the Emperor have much power since 1916. And if you look at image number 5, the military leadership is these two people to the right and the left of the emperor. In particular, the guy to the right, Erich Ludendorff. And Ludendorff decides in September 1918 that the war is essentially lost. So he tells the civilian establishment that they have to sue for peace immediately, and a new government should be appointed, a government that should include Social Democrats. Now, he does not want to include Social Democrats because he likes Social Democrats, but because he wants the Social Democrats to be sort of in charge together with the liberals, so they can be blamed when it comes to having to negotiate the end of the war. So Ludendorff wants to prepare for the exit for the conservative establishment. And the Social Democrats are very eager, people such as Friedrich Ebert, to take over. Ebert's vision is to become the Chancellor of Germany. Theoretically, the party is committed to creating a republic, but Ebert really would like the emperor to continue as the emperor. But it becomes increasingly clear that that will not be possible because there's a sailors' revolt. And the sailors' revolt, which incidentally surprises even some revolutionaries, because the Spartacists and the revolutionary shopkeepers have been preparing for an uprising as well. Maybe I should say something very briefly about the revolutionary shopkeepers. It's a group of about 1,000 people, unionists, metal workers. They don't really like electoral politics. They like to organize within their union. They like practical work. they are distrustful of grand theoretical pronouncements, and they have an ear to the ground. Even though it's only about 1,000 of them, they actually have profound roots within the working class and can influence, if necessary, and mobilize tens, if not hundreds of thousands of workers. So these metal workers and the Spartakists, but emphasis here on the metal workers, are preparing for an uprising, and they're in some ways preempted because there is a sailors' rebellion in the north. And the sailors don't want to carry out the orders of the Imperial Navy anymore. At the point when the war is lost, the Navy wants to make one last-ditch effort to sacrifice the Navy. It's militarily senseless, but they want to make a statement in order to create sort of martyrs for the time after the war. And the sailors don't want to be sacrificed for something nonsensical like that, so they rise up and arrest their officers, create sailors' councils, and soldier and sailors' councils will come into existence all over Germany. So, to fast forward and simplify a fairly complicated story, the question will essentially be, what will happen next in the midst of the old system collapsing, the old system falling apart, because the emperor is now forced to abdicate, and there will be two visions of what the future of Germany should be. One vision will be represented by a centrist social democrat named Philipp Scheidemann, who is an associate of Friedrich Ebert. Scheidemann will proclaim a liberal republic. The other vision will be represented by Karl Liebknecht, who will proclaim on November 9th the socialist republic. And these two declarations don't just differ in terms of names, they differ in content. A socialist republic would not only mean, you know, in medium term, the construction of a different type of society, a socialist society, it would also mean the break with the old power structure. The old power structure in terms of the military leaders, the generals, they would have to be sent into retirement, some of them perhaps into prison for the things they have done during the war and elsewhere. The same would apply to the old judiciary, all the old judges, the entire legal system, and the entire state bureaucracy. The idea here is, if you want to create a new society, you must get rid of the old society and the personnel attached to the old society. That was one option. The other option, the Scheidemann option, was to make a compromise with the old system. And this option is the option that the Social Democrats really push for. And the last point before I turn things over to Charles, I want to stress is the agreement, the secret agreement between Ebert and Groener. Ebert, picture number two, Groener, picture number four. Wilhelm Groener is now the chief military officer. And Ebert and Groener actually have something in common. They know each other. They have had interactions before. They have a somewhat similar background. They're both from southwest Germany. One is from Württemberg, one is from Baden. They both come from relatively humble beginnings. Their parents were craftsmen and they're office people, even though Groener is a general. He spends most of the year in charge of the railroad, doing desk work. So they're both workhorses, they're office people. They understand each other in their love for law and order. And when they hear socialism, councils, they think of disorder and chaos. Ebert famously said, "I fear revolution like the sin." So they agree something has to be done, and thus they kind of make a deal. And the deal is the Social Democrats and the army will help one another. The Social Democrats will say, we understand the radical left, the Spartakists, the shopkeepers, the shop stewards, the left wing of the USPD, the Independent Social Democrats. These people are troublemakers. So if something horrible were to happen to them, in terms of right-wing militias like the Free Corps that have been created, we will look the other way. We will not interfere with the army. We will not retire any massive amounts of generals. We will let the army run itself as before. We will not interfere with the judiciary, with the police apparatus. We will not touch what is today called the deep state. In return for these privileges, we expect you to, well, support us. We scratch your back, you have to scratch our back now. Meaning you support the liberal republic, which is a compromise. It gives some protection to the old elites, but in return you have to do something for us. And they will offer certain things, because the old elites are really threatened. Their power hangs on a threat. And essentially what they agree to is an 8-hour workday, a recognition of collective bargaining agreements, eventually the right for women to work, something the working class movement pushed for quite a long time, and a couple of other minor perks. And this is sort of, in Ebert's limited imagination, the extent of what socialism could possibly mean. Now, the question then is, will the right-wingers keep their part of the bargain? Will Gröner, will the military establishment respect this deal and work with the centrists? Well, if you take a look at the other two pictures at the very bottom, you sort of see the answer, and I will elaborate on that after Charles has said what he's going to say.
So I can't speak in a German accent, but I did grow out my beard to do an imitation of all of our favorite German, so doing the best I can. Thanks again to Axel for a great presentation and this really helpful timeline that I think is going to be useful to me as well and all of you as we go through this, because I know it's not always the easiest thing to go through a lot of complex narrative and political points. So. As Axel went through, the SPD, and with help from the USPD, betrays the working class on August 4th, 1914. And after revolutionary mass strikes and mutinies in the Army and Navy, helps save German capitalism and rebuild its state apparatus. So the challenge that the communists have after this is, one, how to become a mass party. Two, how to solve the problem that the majority of the working class still backs social democracy in its various brands, right, SPD, left, in the USPD, and how to force the Social Democrats and to form a bloc with the communists for working class power instead of forming a bloc with the bourgeois parties where they remain a junior partner. And I want to cover how the Communist Party of Germany, as part of a world communist movement, develop strategy and tactics to solve these problems that in this period. So I want to start not in Germany, but with the First Congress of the Communist International, and just remind ourselves that the developments in Germany were intimately tied up with the developments in Russia. There were three mass anti-war strikes in Germany The first one was detonated by Carl Liebknecht being sent to the front and kicked out of parliament. The second one happened a month after the February Revolution in Russia. People in Germany were paying close attention to what was going on across the border. And the third and the biggest strike before the revolution happens a month after the November Revolution in Russia. So it was part of the same world movement, and the revolutionaries in Germany continued to take inspiration from the example in Russia. And the perspective of the Bolsheviks that Alex laid out for us was not a fantasy. There were workers' councils in Germany, Poland, Italy in 1919, full-blown Soviet republics in Hungary and South Bavaria and Southwest Germany. It was the beginning of the two red years in Italy, which culminate in the factory occupations in 1920. Europe was objectively revolutionary in these years, and the Communist International was organized to provide leadership. But the first Congress was really the Bolsheviks and foreign revolutionaries who they could recruit out of POW camps, and radicals who happened to be in Russia, coincidentally. They were in the middle of a civil war where the other side was backed by 14 capitalist powers. There was a blockade. It was very difficult to get there. So they put out propaganda, agree on some principles, and set themselves the tasks of separating the pro-capitalist leaders of the social democracy in Germany, but all of the countries, from the revolutionary workers who had just overthrown the Kaiser in Germany and were building workers' councils throughout Europe. And it becomes a rallying point for the groups who were revolutionary but were outside of this traditional social democracy, like revolutionary syndicalist groupings in France, and the left-wing elements within social democracy, like the Spartacus Bund and the revolutionary shop stewards that Alex took us through. So if you look at the timeline, let's see, the back of Alex's timeline, and look at the election results for 1920, you can see that the SPD has gone from 39% to 22%, and the independent Social Democratic Party, the people that the Social Democrats kicked out in 1917, has gone from 0 to 18%. So tremendous losses from the SPD to its left. The SPD was very, the USPD was very strong in the Reichstag after this, very strong in the German Metal Workers Union, which was the largest union in the world at the time, and it was the most strategically important union in Germany. And the perspective of the leadership of the Communist Party, primarily Paul Levy, was winning over the left wing of the USPD to communism, fusion with the KPD, and having a mass revolutionary party in Germany. And it's this leftward movement within the USPD that becomes a critical factor in the development of German communism. I want to take a second, though, to speak about an event in March of 1920 that has gone down in history as the Kapp-Putsch. So, for the German capitalist class and the army, no social democrat was right-wing enough to be tolerated in the government. So you have Scheidemann and Ebert, both terrible. They had spent the previous 2 years putting down the workers' councils that existed all throughout Germany. But they couldn't be relied on the same way that setting out that replacing it with a military dictatorship could. So there was an attempt at a coup against the Scheidemann government that was completely defeated by a general strike against the attempt at the putsch. In the aftermath of this strike, Karl Liebknecht, someone who speaks German, I'll correct me on the pronunciation, but proposes forming a government of all the workers' parties and the unions. What you have to understand about this guy is, like, he's like a Richard Trumka figure, but he figures out, hey, the army wants to kill us. We need to fight back and defend ourselves. At this point, the German communists say, yes, we support the formation of this sort of government, and we would be a loyal opposition to it. the attempt to do this flounders, but it sets the stage for a similar policy that the communists have in the future. So moving from Germany back to Russia, I want to say a little bit about the second Congress of the Communist International. One, this is the first Congress of the Comintern that represents like real communist groups with forces in mature parties. It also has a delegation from the Independent Socialist Party, the USPD, and their delegation is split. There's Crispin and Dittmann for the right wing, and a guy named Daumig and Stauker for the left. This Congress was notable for providing theoretical clarity on a whole host of questions: the role of the Communist Party, the national question, the agrarian question. But of special interest to us in this discussion is the relationship of communists to the areas of mass work, the trade unions, and the elections. Okay, fabulous, thank you. And what was known as left communism was super popular at the time. So the basic ideas of left communism were that reformist institutions were dominated by the social democratic bureaucrats, like the unions, true, and that Soviets were better than parliament, also true, and that all you needed to do was just tell people this and they would join the communists. So there's a true kernel of this. Soviets are better than bourgeois democracy, and the social democratic bureaucrats were terrible. The Social Democratic Trade Union Federation, even before August 14th, when the Social Democrats vote for war credits in the Reichstag, when they see the war is coming, they say, we won't do anything to oppose the war effort, we will not strike against the war, and they signed what was known as the civil peace. The social democracy was acting as the left wing of the bourgeoisie within the Reichstag. But just repeating this at social democratic workers does nothing to break them from the Social Democratic Party. Otherwise, they would have already joined the communists. And this is why a guy named Lenin wrote a whole book about this, which to this day is still his most important strategic contribution to the trade union movement. And it's really the starting point for revolutionary socialists and the trade unions today. I mean, it's not the end point. We've learned a lot in the last 90-odd years, but it's still the starting point. And so this is how Lenin responded to the communists who didn't want to work inside the German trade unions. He says, yet it is this very absurdity that the German left communists perpetrate when, because of the reactionary and counter-revolutionary character of the trade union top leadership, they jump to the conclusion that we must withdraw from the trade unions, refuse to work in them, and create new and artificial forms of labor organization. This is so unpardonable a blunder that it is tantamount to the greatest service communists could render the bourgeoisie. To refuse to work in the reactionary trade unions means leaving the insufficiently developed or backward masses of workers under the influence of the reactionary leaders, the agents of the bourgeoisie, the labor aristocrats, or workers who have been completely bourgeois. So this doesn't mean that like we should just go anywhere where there's good people. Like the trade unions are the basic organization of our class. It's the site for unity and struggle. It's where we take on the employers. Incidentally, the book is Left Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder, by the way. I don't think I mentioned the title. You can pick it up in Haymarket. I think this refutes the idea that Lenin didn't understand Western Europe and European conditions. He certainly understood it better than the theoreticians of abstention from the unions who lived there. 10 left, you said? Okay. Let's say one more thing about the Second Congress. The strategy was to separate the pro-capitalist leaders from the masses to form genuine parties. And the leaders of these groups had to be removed, not because they were scum who betrayed our class. They were, and they did. But because you couldn't make a socialist revolution with these people at the head of their parties. Christian Rakowski, who's in my top five favorite communist lists, at the third Congress, speaks to this question, but I'm going to quote it here because it's relevant to why these people had to be gotten rid of. You created a theory of specialists. Your parliamentary deputies, they may be the best strategists, and with them you can form an excellent government, but you will never carry out a revolution. Together with Regola and Derrigona, so these are the Italian Scheidemann's and Trumka's. You are able to sabotage the marvelous metalworkers movement, but you cannot carry out a revolution. With a party leadership that attempts to hide its internal disagreements from the workers, that heeds the principle that dirty linen should be washed indoors, you can formulate the best of intentions, but they will remain platonic because you cannot carry out a revolution with such leaders. And it's, these people would do anything, vote for anything, make any promises to stay in control of these organizations. So our movement came up with a bunch of conditions for groups to adhere to. There were 21 of them. They're called the 21 conditions. And groups that didn't want to adopt those conditions could not join the Comintern. So the USPD has to decide whether it's going to adopt these conditions or not and join the Communist International. Two delegations go home. The right-wing USPD members start to organize against the 21 conditions. Stoker and Domig. Domig, incidentally, was Richard Mueller's best friend. Mueller was the leader of the Revolutionary Shop Stewards, both very interesting and underrated figures. And Gregory Zinoviev, who is the leader, who is the chairperson of the Communist International, arrives in Halle, a town in Germany, where the Congress was being held. When he got there, he was like, "Halle at your boy." But he's there to represent. He's there to represent the Communist International, and debates the Menshevik leader, Julius Martov. And again, you can see the interconnection between the German and Russian revolutions. The Mensheviks send over their spokesperson to combat the Comintern in Germany. Speaks for 3.5 hours, wins over the waivers, and the USPD votes to accept the 21 conditions and join the Communist International. At this point, the right wing declares that they refuse to take discipline, the Congress made a mistake, and they split. And I think we should draw the lesson that right wing social democratic leaders will never accept being in a minority. They will split or they will expel you, so, as they did in the American Socialist Party in the year before, where they expelled three quarters of its membership. These are not nice people. They're always for bourgeois democracy ahead of working class unity. So finally, 2 years after its founding, the KPD is a mass party of 200,000 members, overwhelmingly industrial workers. And it's a long way from 1914, where Rosa Luxemburg called an anti-war meeting and couldn't get anyone to attend other than Clara Zetkin and Franz Mehring. They didn't have enough people for a Dungeons and Dragons game at this anti-war meeting. And during the worst period of the anti-war reaction, when comrades around him were despondent, Lenin said, "Look, oh, good, thank you." Said, "Look, today it's us plus the Dutch plus zero, but that's fine because one day it's going to be us plus everybody." He wasn't quite right. It wasn't the Comintern. The Comintern didn't have everybody. He turned out to be slightly off, but he went from being isolated internationally to being the leader of a movement that organized millions, including 300,000 in Germany. And we should take this to heart, not because we want to be a minority and be small, but we want to share Lenin's confidence in the working class and its combativity and its consciousness, and understand that in the right conditions, we can grow. And one of these conditions is the contradiction of social democracy and its attempt to be a mass party of workers while being the left wing of bourgeois democracy. So I don't have a ton more time. I do need to say a couple things about the United Front. But first I want to say something about what the German party was like. Compared to the social democracy, its members were younger and lower skilled occupations and more likely to be in an industrial versus a craft union. That was an important distinction. I don't have time to go into it, but it plays a factor in different strategies within the trade unions that the KPD and SPD went through. The geographic strength of the KPD was in Rhineland-Westphalia, in the Ruhr, and in the heart of German heavy industry. That's a lot like the Rust Belt in this country and what used to be the industrial corridor in this country from West Virginia running west to Wisconsin. But the USPD left wing wanted to be communists. Like, they wanted to join the Comintern. The SPD is still large and has its organization and its cadres intact, how do you win them over? Because you also need them to fight the capitalists as well. And unity is nice, and like we had unity, there was unity in the streets in the revolution of 1918 and on a lot of the strikes and the cap putsch, but the communists were not leading anything. At least in the instance of the cap putsch, that's a good thing because the lead they were putting out was terrible, and they were saying there's no difference between bourgeois democracy and a military dictatorship backed by the army. So sometimes it's nice to have no influence. But it doesn't take a genius to join a strike that the SPD calls. It doesn't take any new tactical innovations to join something that someone else is doing. The problem that we had is that the Social Democrats didn't want to do anything because they were tied to the bourgeois parties. How do you get their members to fight the employer? How do you get the revolutionary workers who are in these parties to fight the employers with you? The Stuttgart metal workers in late 1920 came up with five points an action program. One note on the Stuttgart metal workers, they were the people who convinced Karl Liebknecht that he made a mistake when he voted for the war credits and he should reverse his position and go back and vote against the war in the Reichstag, which he does. It also makes a difference that the president of the metal workers local in Stuttgart is a KPD member. So they put out a call for the following: reduce prices for the necessities of life, produce at full capacity and increase unemployment benefits, reduce taxes paid for by workers and raise taxes on the great private fortunes, establish workers' control of supply and distribution of raw materials and foodstuffs, disarm reactionary gangs, and arm the workers. So you have a very nice combination of economic demands that the trade unions should be already fighting on and that the social democracy should also, and some political demands, which is what you need inside a trade union movement. And that got a lot of currency and a lot of locals of the metal workers unions. Inside the KPD, there is a debate with some of the more leftish elements, but it gets published with Karl Radek, another one of our top five favorite communists, and they start. I see you, Sean. And there's genuine negotiations with the SPD and the rump of the USPD in the Union Federation. They put out eight demands. They're very similar to the five demands of the Stuttgarters. I'm not going to go through all of them. There's nothing in there about Soviet power or the dictatorship of the proletariat. That would be a call to join the Communist Party. And you need a mix of economic demands, no matter how strong you are in the union, because there has to be a next step outside of the workplace to win workers too. The social democratic bureaucracy doesn't want to do it. And John Riedel, who, along with Mike Tabor, who's in the back of the room, has done a tremendous job at editing documents so our movement can actually have this history today. John says this about why the Social Democrats didn't want to go along with this action program. For the Social Democratic bureaucracy, United Initiatives were a loser, shifting focus to the terrain of mass action where the bureaucracy could be rapidly bypassed. The KPD's United Front initiatives resulted in a draining away of SPD support to the communists, regardless of whether or not the SPD joined in United Actions. This was particularly true in the unions, where communist influence was now rapidly increasing. The SPD leadership viewed the United Front campaigns as partisan, an attempt to shift the relationship of forces in the KPD's favor. There was a kernel of truth to this. Only by radically increasing its influence in the unions and the working class could the KPD exert the pressure needed to force the Social Democratic parties and ADGB into united action and ultimately to create the preconditions for revolutionary victory. That lasts for about 2 months until March. I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to be able to speak much to this. But the KPD leadership loses its head and decides to launch an insurrection in central Germany. The important question, I think, for us is, why did so many of its members lose their heads in March of 1921? And I think the answer is, hundreds of thousands of workers had left the SPD to the USPD, moving left, and then left the USPD to the KPD, moving left. And they thought, now that we finally have a mass party, we can force events. You couldn't. That's why you needed the United Front and the set of strategies around that and the attempt to put pressure on the Social Democrats and lead their members. And if this sounds like semi-anarchist nonsense, like that they could just force action and force the events, you're right, you have good judgment, but a lot of us, if we were there, would have been ultra-left too, because that was the experience that people had after 9 years of, sorry, 7 years of war and counter-revolution. Last point on 1921. It's a horrible disaster. Thousands of people lose their jobs, are arrested, or killed. But they're able to make, with help from the Comintern's Third Congress, don't have any time to speak to that. People should listen to Jen Rush's excellent talk on We Are Many and her articles on this in the ISR. The Third Comintern Congress is able to keep the KPD intact and keep it from disintegrating, which it was very close to doing. This is mid-1921, which is where the talk is supposed to end, but I just want to say two things about 1923. 1923 was the last chance, as Axel pointed out, and it wasn't a question in 1923 of the absence of a strong Communist Party. They had 350,000 members, were at parity of strength with the Social Democrats and the key trade unions. The problem was the French occupation of the Ruhr, the key part of German heavy industry, how to resolve that three-cornered fight between the German bosses, the German workers, and the occupying French army, and the fact that the strike wave is peaking before the KPD leadership knows what to do and is ready. So strikes are accelerating, and they're not ready for, and they start holding strikes back the way that the SPD leadership and the USPD leadership had been before. There's a growth of the right wing in this period. There's an attempt to do an anti-fascist day under bad advice from the Comintern. They call it off. The strikes accelerate. And they don't know what to do up until the point where Rudolf Hilferding, a USPD member, people might have heard of his book, Finance Capital. It's quoted at length by Lenin and his imperialism. Hilferding comes in and enacts a number of economic policies that stabilize the German economy. A lot of us have heard about the German October, Heinrich Braunler, KPD leader, goes to Moscow, is given instructions to start the revolution in Central Germany. That was a problem, but the bigger problem was that the strike wave and the militancy of the German workers had peaked 2 months before. Sean Larson's in the room. He's done a bunch of great work on this. I don't have any more time, so maybe I'll let him speak to that in the discussion. But the lessons we should really take are: don't trust the Social Democrats. The bigger the stakes are, the more they will betray you, and the more important the betrayal will be. And also, unless we present our own demands and our own initiatives in an attempt to win their membership over, the membership of the Social Democrats who want socialism, every member of the USPD and Social Democratic Party was for socialism on paper in this period. Unless you present an alternative action program to win them over, there is no hope of winning them in practice to revolution.
So I will just for about 5 minutes or so attempt to do what normally would take 15 hours. So I just want to read a quote by Chris Harmon, Pierre Bouet, on the KPD, kind of summarizing the potential and the limitations of the KPD, which is, I think, quite poignant. He wrote, quote, "The KPD had workers' leaders, tested organizers such as Heinrich Brandler, theoreticians such as August Thalheimer, people able to coordinate strikes. organize demonstrations and lead forces of stewards who could both fight and die at their posts. It could call upon good speakers for its mass meetings and in parliamentary debates. Underground workers who were skillful conspirators, talented journalists, and people who could write books and aim machine guns. Both of them at the same time. And there was no one who could, but there was no one who could, with his ear on the ground, hear the grass grow, as Lenin liked to say. No one who could find the way forward in a practical, and I might add, very complex situation. So this is what revolutionary organizations have to develop. This very complicated skill to hear the grass grow. It's, you know, of course important to have people who write books. We don't need machine guns right now, I hope. But hearing the grass grow, developing roots within the working class, getting a sense of how the mood changes, how attitudes change. How, for example, in January 1919, most workers were not ready for a full-blown insurrection. But because of disappointments with Social Democrats and even right-wing USPD leaders who promised the socialization of key industries but did not really deliver, instead obfuscated and delayed these kinds of things, so radicalization took place. And the same phenomenon can be observed during and after the Kapp Putsch. And it's important for revolutionary organizations to have a sense of what's going on, as opposed to tailing behind and always finding out, you know, 2 weeks later how the mood has changed. Good. The other thing I want to do very briefly is call your attention to the numbers in terms of electoral results once more. The so-called Weimar Coalition, 1919, the coalition of the Social Democratic Party, the Center Party, a moderate Catholic conservative party, and the small DDP, the small liberal party. They got fairly good results. The Communist Party was not running in this election, and the USPD only got 5.23%. But when you look at the election in 1920, the situation changed completely. The Social Democrats lost half of their membership for obvious reasons. The USPD got almost as many members, but the other members of the Weimar coalition lost. The Center Party lost, and the small Liberal Party got even smaller. And this so-called Weimar coalition that was supposed to be the key network of support for the Weimar Republic never again really came to power during the Weimar Republic. And what we see over time is a rise in conservative support in terms of the DNVP and the DVP. But this conservative support is not lasting. If we look at the election, for example, of 1932, you can see that the DNVP is at 5%, the DVP is at 1%, despite the fact that these two parties were heavily favored by big business, just as Jeb Bush was heavily favored by big business and other people in the Republican Party, more traditionalist Republicans. But who was on the rise? Donald Trump. And I'm not saying he is Hitler, but the Nazis, of course, were the dominant conservative party. So the point here is we are in a somewhat similar situation where there's a reorientation of the conservative camp, in as much as big business has to face the reality that traditional conservatism is not doing well, but there's this new far-right movement, and eventually they ask themselves, what can we get out of it? The communists and the social democrats would have had more votes than the Nazis if they had worked together. Unfortunately, they did not work together because of ideological stupidity on both sides. The communists had their third period where they believed the social democrats were as dangerous as the fascists, and the social democrats thought you cannot work with communists, they're just Moscow stooges. So what I want to do very quickly is to see whether I can read some sort of a conclusion, and this will take only 1 minute. Ideas matter. Organization to implement these ideas matter as well. So we have to think about what kind of an organization we can and must develop in order to push our ideas forward. As Charles pointed out, we cannot rely on social democrats. We cannot rely on left-wing social democrats on the USPD either, because many key USPD leaders just wanted to lead their followers back into the Social Democratic Party under the auspices of reforming it, turning it to the left, and we all know how that worked out. Numbers are important, but they're not everything. The Communist Party, when it was created, only had about 4,000 members. By the summer of 1919, they had over 100,000 members. But they were still incredibly ineffective. And even later on, at the end of the Weimar Republic, when they had about 400,000 members, they were far less effective than one would have expected from an organization of that size. Now, would it be nice for us to have 100,000 members, 400,000 members? Absolutely, but it's also a matter of how these members are organized and what degree of class consciousness they display, and many of those people there were under the sway of what Lenin called left-wing radicalism. So the dangers of ultra-leftism and absenteeism at the same time. So the tedious work, sometimes tedious work, of organizing on the ground, building networks, working with other people without giving up or compromising your principles, being there, supporting struggles, even if you don't agree with all the slogans, putting up your slogans, your alternative ideas, but being present where the people are, I think those are some of the key lessons. Okay, thank you very much.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.